Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590 The Fan. Blake Murphy. Ailish Forfar. J.D. Bunkus. That woman, Ailish Forfar. Leafs win 5-0 last night. Awesome, awesome, awesome start to the playoffs. Couldn't ask for anything better. Keep your texts coming. 590, 590. We'll be sprinkling them in throughout the day. Ailish, other than someone referring to you as that woman, is there anything popping in the text line? What's going on?
Yeah, Chuck from Oshawa sent in a lengthy text, but he said, "What I take from that woman." Come on, Chucky. There's so much in the text line. Obviously, Leafs heavy, so we'll just start with, we'll go through order of those people that texted. So they were up early. Congratulations. Jason in Toronto. So, so happy with the Leafs last night.
Did you just congratulate someone for being up early? Sorry.
Yeah. For getting their text read. Okay. They're early in the text line. So, so happy with last night's text. They've preached killer instinct since they were eliminated last year, and I want to see that again in game two. Put your foot on their throats. Go, Leafs, go. He's right about the all the offseason narrative was like, we didn't have that killer instinct. We didn't have that drive. We didn't have, you know, what it took, that edge. And we said it this morning. They certainly showed that when their backs were up against the wall with the adversity they faced in the first 10 minutes with all the penalties. I think you're right, Jason. Killer instinct will be very important, especially when the Tampa Bay Lightning come back tomorrow with a completely different energy, I assume.
So, yeah, I'm sure Tampa will respond. And I thought Cooper's comments after the game about how Toronto didn't need to be a very good team to beat us, to me that wasn't poor sportsmanship. To me that was
a shot
at his own team because they were flat. Let's be honest. Toronto played an awesome game. Can't we admit this? Toronto was incredible. They deserve all the credit in the world. There's zero taking away of credit from Toronto here. But Tampa also stunk. They didn't have a shot. Even straight, like they were threatening. When was the times I went over at the beginning of the show? When were the times that you felt scared of Tampa Bay? It was a tire fire game for them. They were horrific, 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 horrific game. Their best players were their worst players. So, two things can be true. But with Toronto, I'm so glad that this listener brought up the killer instinct thing because so much of it was they didn't add killer instinct, right? They didn't add it before the season. Bunting wasn't killer instinct. Kampf wasn't killer instinct. Richie wasn't killer instinct. So where did they get the killer instinct from the outside? They didn't. They said that they also believed it could be developed. And last night, I think you saw that. I'm going to stop saying this stuff about, of course, you not got to win a series. But it's game one. Everybody knows that because they say game one, and the series is 1-0 right now, so we don't need to qualify that anymore. But that was killer instinct from Mitch Marner. That was killer instinct from Austin Matthews. That was killer instinct from just about everybody in that lineup. They took their regular season success, they applied it to a Stanley Cup champion, and they whooped the crap out of them last night. So yeah, can they continue it? We'll find out. But as for one night, the only sample we have, they sure look like they developed it.
And I do wonder, too, if Tampa Bay is breakable in this series, not in the sense of like, obviously they have the mental fortitude to go on back-to-back cup runs, but this team at times
they got broken by Columbus,
and this team at times this year, and we talked to Dave Randorf about it yesterday, is like two back-to-back cup runs within a calendar year are exhausting. Like, I know Kucherov's still Kucherov. That was the worst version of Nikita Kucherov I think I've ever seen last night.
No,
like,
awful.
I do wonder if there's a cumulative fatigue here where, look, you're not certainly not when you're up 1-0, but if you could take control of the series, if as this, and hey, there's no extra off days in this series either, right? It's game day, off day all the way through. I wonder if that is adding up and maybe it takes a toll. And so if I were the Leafs, that killer instinct is, it's gotta be there for game two. If it's actually a killer instinct and not just a good first game, it'll be there throughout the series. You're not going to sweep them, but you got to play with that same level of force. No.
I think those guys are a little bit of front runners, and I think that Kucherov is the head front runner of all the front runners. So we'll see. But I've seen Kucherov get rattled many, many times in his career, and he's a guy that I think you can throw off of his game. And if they continue to make him uncomfortable, I don't see him responding by elevating or calming down. I see him getting worse and making that worse for his team.
So similarly to this, hi, Ailish. As the only pro athlete on the show, washed up, that was me, Is it true that Tampa players are less motivated compared to Leafs since they won two cups already? Do pro athletes' motivation levels change like us mere mortals? Thanks. I wouldn't say that the motivation changed. I would say maybe they kind of walked in with a little bit more confidence that they needed and maybe underestimated the Leafs. I think they coasted a little bit at the end of the season, and we talked about that when we talked to Dave Anderchuk and some other Tampa guests that, you know, how you finish the season is important. It's the last perspective of your team and the momentum you carry in. And I think that might be why Tampa kind of felt flat last night. They didn't show up because they thought things would be a little easier. I don't know about the motivation. I'm sure this team would like to three-peat. I just think that maybe they underestimated the Leafs, and we saw that last night.
To be honest, I think that Tampa just had a bad night, and that penalty kill shifted the entire game. That was demoralizing for them because they couldn't get a chance on net during a 5-minute power play after they had scored 4 times against the Leafs in the regular season. I think it shook them up a little bit, and I think Toronto took all the energy from the fans, and they took all the energy from that kill, and they pushed it into the rest of the game. And Tampa did not have a counterpunch. They had a slight little counterpunch at the beginning of the second period. You thought, okay, are they going to? Nope. That it was annoying almost having the shot graphic up there because the shot graphic was, oh, it's pretty even in shots for the vast majority of the game. And then they would say the attempts, and it was double. And everybody with eyes knew that this was a dominant performance by Toronto, especially given all the minutes on the penalty kill. So, to me, I don't know if Tampa, a cup-contending team, underestimates the Leafs. That seems like a stretch to me when it's two professional organizations, one that's as well-coached as Tampa is, back-to-back cups. I don't think that they underestimate teams, especially given their failures of the past. I just think that the Leafs caught them in a weird game where they played it perfectly, and they could not find the wherewithal to respond in that one. And then once it became like 3-0, their mind started to shift to, we need game two.
Yeah, I think that's a real thing. And that bounce back, we Dave Randorf gave us some stats yesterday when we were talking about Vasilevsky. And, hey, he's 15-0 coming off a loss in the playoffs. And I had the stat of he's only had a sub-900 save percentage in back-to-back games twice during these runs. It will be interesting to see what this series looks like if the Leafs can take care of home ice again tomorrow. Because in the last two cup runs, Tampa Bay hasn't trailed by two in a series. We haven't seen them like that. And obviously the Columbus thing is not too far out of memory. They also got behind 2 to Washington the year prior to that and then ended up making it a 7-game series. So, you know, this core has shown that fight before, and I think the two cups probably outweigh the Columbus thing. But we haven't seen it. We haven't seen this team have to play from behind very often in games, and we certainly haven't seen them have to play from behind very often in series recently. So
they won one cup. They won the bubble cup. The bubble cup doesn't count. I'm sorry. The bubble cup, Tampa has 1.5 cups is the most I'll give them. I'll give them 1.5, and I think that's actually pretty generous of me giving them 1.5. Like, who thinks that there was anything that for the choker team, which they were as well, to win their first championship in front of no fans and in a hotel where all the guys wanted to go back to be with their families? Yeah, okay. Congrats to you guys, but we all know the truth. You beat the Stars and the Habs.
Tampa has the one advantage of they're the only city in the league where you'd rather be stuck at a hotel in some nondescript bubble than be at home in Tampa.
I know. I just think sometimes we talk about these guys like they're the back-to-back Stanley Cup champions stuff. It bothers me just a little bit in comparing them to great teams from the past. They're a great team. They got lots of good players. They got this great goaltender. There's lots. But they've collapsed in the past. They haven't shown this incredible mental fortitude. I don't think anyways. I just, they're a little overrated. That's all.
I will say that maybe just lengthy playoff experience, even though you don't really give them the most credit for the bubble, I think playing
zero credit
in two lengthy playoff runs does give you a little bit of an edge.
Also, JD, I got a wrestling brain this a little bit. Is you can't bury your opponent like you're doing. You got to put your opponent over. That way you look even stronger coming out of it. If you beat a jabroni team, it doesn't mean anything. You just beat a jabroni team. If they're the two-time, it sounds way better to beat the two-time defending champs than beat the 1.5-time defending champs.
When they won the cup in 1920, they beat Columbus, right?
1920.
What's going on?
No, 2019-20 season. 1920.
Oh, I thought you meant like the year. I was like, wow, that's this is a
you guys watch sports? Like,
you,
like,
I thought
you were like,
going 100 years ago the way you said
me too, and I thought this was going to be some sort of like evolution.
I thought it was a Leafs
history
lesson, not a
18, 19, 19, 20, 20, 20. That's the way that I talk about years in sports. I'm sorry.
I always refer to the championship side of the season. Like, it's that's a 2020 Stanley Cup to me. But anyway.
When they won that year in 2020, I'll do it that way for you guys. They beat Columbus, they beat the Islanders, and they beat the Stars in the Cup Finals. And the Bruins, they beat in five games because the Bruins, that was the Stanley Cup that year. And there were some close games in that one, but that was it. They beat the Panthers, that was the Stanley Cup last year because they got the Islanders again, and the Islanders almost took them out, if you remember. They got Montreal Canadiens. Like, these guys have beat essentially nobody for two cups, and one of them was in a bubble. Just saying. Wrestling Brandon all you want, but I'm just saying, yeah, I don't have a lot of respect for them like I do other great teams that have won multiple cups. I have a lot of respect for the goaltender. I had a lot of respect for Stamkos coming back and battling when he tried to come back from injury. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of respect for Hedman. I think that he's one of the best defensemen who ever lived, and he's just an absolute freak among freaks. I'm just saying that a lot of those guys are gone. They've had some turnover. Not the scariest two-time defending champions of all time. Anyway, what's next?
So lots of praise in the text line for the crowd. Just the way that the energy at Scotiabank helped shift the game. Cam and Kitchener texted in, I bought tickets last minute yesterday and I was really worried it was a poor choice. Best decision ever. Crowd was the best that I've ever seen.
Yeah. I'll be honest. I was never going to go to that game. I couldn't swing it. It was way too hard. But I thought, you know what, you should just go to this game. And I have all-time FOMO. Like, the most FOMO that's ever FOMO'd, I have it. Because all I could think of was when Matthews bombed that power play goal, that place would have been the most euphoric that you could imagine. And again, I don't blame Leaf fans for being happy. There's been nothing. Leaf fans have had nothing to be happy about in the playoffs for years. So the idea that you wouldn't want to be happy on a night where you whoop the crap out of the Tampa Bay Lightning in that type of fashion and you wouldn't want to set the roof on fire would be incredible. Think about all these other fan bases too. They celebrate those wins and nobody talks about it. It's only here because people are jealous. So whatever. Just let them be jealous and enjoy the game.
Similar text. I was there at Scotiabank Arena. Tampa didn't show up at all. The Leafs played great, but the real takeaway is when the Leafs players stick up for each other. Perry tried to rough us up, and it didn't work. Leafs need to be tough and play with grit.
I agree. The Leafs looked awesome responding to the physical play. But this is something we had seen, and Keith brought this up, right? Keith has mentioned this before the series started, that they had dealt with physicality well this season. And I thought this year, more than ever before, they had actually done that. And when you look at the additions that they put onto this team, there are some no-nonsense, don't-back-down dudes. Who is in the scrum? Labushkin, right? Mm-hmm. He's not afraid of anybody.
The big bear, the Russian
big bear.
Even Engvall.
Engvall had a little moment there where he's like
Engvall's
throwing a
little
punch.
Tall that he needs to be in there and he needs to rough people up. All season long, though, I didn't get the physicality I wanted from Engvall, but he showed it last night.
They never, I can't remember a time this year anyways where they were soft, like where they just got completely rolled by physical play and they couldn't handle it whatsoever and they looked like they were having a meltdown. And we've seen that in years past. We've seen that in iterations of the past. Don't remember that this year. Think that their star players took that more on themselves. This was a chippier Austin Matthews than we've ever seen before. Think there was a trickle-down effect. Think they added the right guys with Giordano and Labushkin and you saw their playoff value last night. I thought it was a great performance from them in terms of responding to the physical play. There's not going to be as many fights. Obviously, Clifford ended up going too far, and that sort of backfired, but it worked out in the long run. Either way, I really do believe that this team is different, and you saw part of the reason why last night is that they can't be bullied.
Okay, text here says, it sounded like the year 1920, just saying. That wasn't me that texted in.
I don't like when you have the control of the manipulation.
We're trying to prove my points.
This hurts my feel. It makes me want to go to the text line and be like, hey, everyone, the whole text line is now about who's right about this. Don't poke the bear, as Matt Devlin would say.
Okay, so Andrew in St. John has a great text. It was a great confidence game for the Leafs. The players needed that to score their first goals and potentially quelled their self-doubt. Campbell secured a shutout, didn't let in a cheesy goal slip to break the goose egg and rattle him. But I don't expect the Lightning to roll over and let the rest of the series go by. Game two looks to be a doozy, and provided everyone is still in the lineup, should be an interesting clash.
That was a text. He didn't submit that essay in the school portal.
There was
I love that essay, though. That was a great essay.
No, it was very good. And I'm glad someone mentioned...
In summation.
Yeah, that's a classic word filler.
I hear two, 4
points. In summation so many times.
Yeah.
Glad someone mentioned Jack, though, because obviously a 23-save shutout is a little further down the checklist with all the things that were good last night.
But it's
it was like a 3-save shutout. But yeah,
after the first period, and they had, 5 shots? Like, that's difficult as a goaltender. I know, JD, you were one. But, like, just
Right. Yeah, no, I don't think so.
JD never went a period only facing 5 shots. JD didn't go... JD didn't go a penalty kill without facing 5 shots.
Did you guys see Jack's... They rolled a highlight reel of him at one point in that game where they went, Jack Campbell, stand tall, and they showed... a point shot that was a clear path to the net that went in his glove. They showed one that went off his crest. I went, wow, okay, this is quite the highlight reel. I couldn't have, but I will say that it was a little telling in that text, but he said he didn't let in and get rattled. And that's a little telling in terms of how the fan base still feels about Jack. He played great in terms of he did exactly what we needed him to do, and that is the whole ask of Leaf fans. They're saying, you don't have to be our most important player. You don't have to be Vasilevsky. You don't have to outplay Vasilevsky. What you need to do is not break our backs. And that's still the goal for Campbell. He did great in game one, but a lot of people, if you're going to say what didn't get proven in that game, I would say Jack is number one despite having a shutout.
I would agree with that. And if you look back to last year, Jack was obviously very, very good in that series overall. But his worst performance was after a shutout. And I'm not saying that, you know, there's going to be a slingshot effect there or anything.
Unnecessary stat.
But,
I heard that.
Well, I'm just saying that, like, you can – I just mean it's not necessarily a huge confidence builder because the series is long. I do get a real kick out of the highlight package, though, and Justin Bourne's probably sitting there like, the puck freezes above average. The puck freezes above average. Look at how good he is at freezing his puck.
Yeah. I
will say I haven't related to an NHL player more than the post-game quote of Campbell saying he's been watching Ozark to calm down and called last night a relaxing evening with the cats.
So I don't want to hear anything about Ozark because I haven't gotten around to this last season. So I'm moving off of that immediately. Even the mention of it, I've watched that terrible show for 5 seasons. The least I can do is not have it end spoiled for me. I thought he was a little swimmy early. He lost his net a few times. He didn't seem to see the puck very well. Just saying. I that's a tough thing to say about a guy after a shutout. I get it. I'm not trying to be that guy. But you tell me how you guys felt during moments of that game early when the puck was bouncing around the net the few times it did. Whether Jack looked like he was... He looked a little swimming around-ish.
Like a little Mrazek-y, a little bit Mrazek-y.
He didn't inspire a ton of confidence early, but I will say that he shut the door late, and he looked awesome late. He never let in that bad goal. That matters way more than JD's old half-cocked assessment about him losing his net or almost goals that happened, right? So goals didn't happen, so congrats to Jack, but he still needs to prove that he can play in the series when Tampa starts to play with some force. If they ever do.
And hey, this is the benefit of playing a strong defensive game too, right? You pick your goalie up if he's, you know, if he was a little shaky to start mentally, right? At least blocked 25 shots last night.
Mm-hmm.
That is crazy. Tampa blocked 11 to give you a frame of reference, and the shot attempts were basically even in terms of shots directed at the net. 25 block shots is one of the highest totals I've ever seen in a game. So good job by the Leafs decor, giving Campbell that extra layer of that extra kind of shell around the high danger areas too.
Okay, we'll fit 2 more in before we have to take a break. We have Ben Wagner after the break. We'll get into some Blue Jays stuff. JD no selling a back-to-back champion like he's peak Hulk Hogan. Andre from Toronto. He's got a little wrestling brain this morning.
Attaboy, Andre.
Interesting about this
one champion, but yeah.
I think that this guy texts in a lot about Tavares, but wow, what a start to the series. Played a great game and looked hungry to win. The only downside for me was $11 million player Tavares needing to figure out a way to leave his mark in the series.
I really don't think that's fair. And this is where I believe confirmation bias comes in, where people have already made up their minds about Tavares. You can tell this guy's texting this in because he's already made up his mind that Tavares stinks. And I would say the most frustrating takes I saw from this game from people were people who went like, and they said that Muzzin couldn't play. You go, why are we focused on stuff like this? You know, it just enjoy the moment. Enjoy all the positive things that came out of that hockey game. The idea that you would watch the Leafs do that and your thought would be, where was Tavares? What do you mean, where was Tavares? The power play was clicking. Look at the play that Matthews scores on, right? They're trying to take away the front of the net. That's how he ends up getting so open, is Belmar makes a decision to cover low, and it leaves Matthews up high, and he barrels down, and he buries one. And you know why they're doing that? Is because a guy like Tavares in front of the net. That we just said that the Stars didn't get to touch the ice for basically the first period of that hockey game because they had to kill penalties for the entire thing. It was a weird game. They got out of control late, so they obviously dialed back on the star players' minutes. Mm-hmm. What did you guys notice Tavares make poor plays? Did you guys notice Tavares?
Nope.
No. He was quality. So the idea that, what, he didn't score a goal in a 5-0 game is so what? He was fine. Don't worry about that. When Tavares plays poorly and the Leafs lose, he'll be accountable.
Then we'll talk.
If he's accountable. But the idea that Tavares wasn't good in that hockey game is outrageous.
Also, very heavy defensive usage in that game for Tavares, which is going to be the case.
That's what we said. That's what the line is.
Look, long series. Everyone's going to, if you're going to win a series, if you're going to beat Tampa Bay, everyone's going to have a game where they've got to step up and they take on a little more. This is, not everyone's going to have their A-plus fastball. Not everyone's going to have their Ben Joyce fastball every game.
Yeah.
Nice. Ben Joyce, our guy. Jay's one to lead into our guest after the break. Can we talk about the Jays game and Montoyo not pinch running for Kirk? That would have scored the leading run and potentially won us a game. It's Jeg from Toronto.
Yes, we can. Sorry.
we certainly can talk about it, Jeg.
Yes, I just didn't have the box score open. I wanted to look at the win probability and stuff like that. So I thought it was a little questionable in the moment as well. It's always tough knowing exactly when to do that, especially because he was they're a little hesitant sometimes to pinch run for a catch or something like that. And he was DH last night, obviously. So,
exactly.
It's not a big deal. I definitely would have. It's also a weird one. Like, there's two outs. So, and you've got the bottom of the order up, and it's only the seventh. So, like, it's one of those funny things where I would imagine what Charlie Montoyo was thinking was it's early enough that Kirk could still conceivably get a high leverage plate appearance in this game. And he did. He led off the bottom of the ninth. However, you maybe were in the lead when whoever, Bradley Zimmer or whoever steps into that spot.
It was Heinemann, and that's why they didn't do it. Is because, let's be honest here.
It was Espinal and Tapia first.
Yeah, it was.
Like, he was on first.
You're right.
With nobody out. So I think the argument would have been pinch run for him because you've got three cracks at this. And even if it's single and you go first to third, then you're in a sack fly position.
Yep.
But yeah, it's the bottom of the order. And I think Charlie was probably managing a little bit for what if we don't get a run this inning, which is tough.
It's a mistake. There's no doubt about it. You had Zimmer at your disposal, and Zimmer's whole thing is that he's an athlete and he 100% scores, right? To me, it was a... Once it got down the lineup, I could see Charlie's thinking of, we don't have a lot of bats in the lineup here. If this game gets extended, we might need somebody. And let's be honest, Tapia is an automatic out. And I know that we're talking about him battling or whatever. He automatic out. Guy's an automatic out. That's what he does best. He slaps balls in the outfield for outs. That's what Tapia is doing the majority of the time. Heinemann hitting that double was amongst the most shocking things in my life. Like, I went, oh my God, what? How? I'm serious. I couldn't believe it. If you would have given me... Like, Vic, our technical director, loves to do the bet the play result. And if he would have given me double as an option, like he'll take double, I would have taken him for everything he was worth. I would have put every single penny that he has on the line in that moment. So it was a shocking.
I honestly thought not pinch hitting for Heinemann was as egregious a decision there as not pinch running for Kirk, right?
Yeah, it could. You could look at it either way, but certainly Kirk should have been pinch run for because he was on base and there was no outs. And even to have Zimmer just been up there and just steal, that would have been great. So no, I think that was a screw up by Charlie, and that's a good text. It's true, he did.
So it's time for something to chew on. Brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum yum yum.
Just a little something to chew on heading into the break, and before we bring in radio voice of the Blue Jays, Ben Wagner. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Garcia comes in to that game in the top of the ninth, gives up a single to Stanton. They pinch run and steal second, and then LeCastro scores on a single. Jimmy Garcia, ERA is up to 4.82 now. He's struck out fewer than 6 per 9. JD, I don't want to make you chew on this too hard, but I don't know that the Jays have their eighth inning righty yet. I know the lefty in high leverage spots is Tim Mayza. We obviously know the closer, and in any emergency situation, is Jordan Romano. But we're looking at Simber or Garcia as that extra right man. And I don't know. I'm chewing on if that's something I can be comfortable with, because I know, JD, that you are not a big Simber in high leverage spots guy.
I just prefer in this era of strikeout artists and so many players striking out that you have someone that does that. So it's no knock on Simber. He's been great. He's one of those dudes, though, where, I'm sorry, I can't help it, but they continue to have good results, good results, good results. And he's a good pitcher, but he's a contact pitcher. And that has its drawbacks. And those drawbacks are, if you have runners on, which happens sometimes when you bring in high-leverage relievers, you got a guy on third, and it's a lot easier to get that guy home than if you're pitching against a strikeout artist. Like, there's just obvious things to this when it comes to baseball in 2022. So it's no knock on Simber. I just think if he's your second highest leverage righty, that's a problem for your baseball team. Jimmy Garcia needs to be that guy, and he's fallen out of the trust tree a little. You can do it's early butt, and that's definitely true, but relievers are different. It's not it's early butt when it comes to relievers. Those guys are judged pretty early, and they're judged pretty heavily on exactly what they do. And Jimmy Garcia now in two big spots against two big opponents in a row has looked very, very human. So he's out of the trust tree. He's obviously not a write-off. I still like the guy. I still like the stuff. But, yeah, you need better than that from him because you are in a – all of a sudden – that's how it's funny how bullpens work where – everything looks great. You look like you have a great bullpen, and then one domino can fall, and you go, oh, my God, this bullpen stinks, you know, and that's how I feel at times with the Jays. Let's take a break. Let's come back, and let's talk about it further with Ben Wagner. Blue Jays play-by-play voice, a guy that has been all over top of some reporting lately, so we'll get into some stuff with him. By the way, you guys see Teoscar Hernandez's arms when he's taking BP? Oh, my God. Teoscar Hernandez. He wishes baseball was played with no sleeves. If I had Teoscar Hernandez's arms, I wouldn't go anywhere with sleeves. Like, that's, he should be furious. He should be like George Costanza arguing for different uniforms, saying that he needs to breathe better because there shouldn't be sleeves. Best arms in the league. Best arms in the league. Let's take a break. Let's talk about him with Ben Wagner, JD Bunkus, Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Blake Murphy, JD Bunkus, Ailish Forfar. Hope you're having a nice little Tuesday. Leafs win last night, 5-0. Our pal Nick Kyprios of Real Kipper and Bourne reporting that Kyle Clifford is scheduled for a phone hearing today with the NHL's Department of Player Safety for that hit on Ross Colton last night. We'll have a little bit more on that later in the show. We've got Jennifer Botterill coming on, Christopher Stieg, Chris Chelios, who might know a thing or two about throwing big hits. So keep an eye out for that. That's that hearing's today. Per Kipper, and obviously make sure you tune into Real Kipper and Bourne a little later on for more on that situation. Not winning last night were the Toronto Blue Jays. They lose 3-2 to the Yankees. Backs against the wall now. can't lose a series. To help us sort through it, Blue Jays play-by-play announcer on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Wagner. How are you this morning, man?
Good morning. Doing well.
So I assume this is JD that put this in our planning document, but who cares about the Jays when the Leafs win a playoff series? If you were ever going to have a bad night as a Jays, picking the night that the Leafs win game one of the playoffs 5-0 was a good night to slide a bad performance by.
I don't know that that's going to be, when you play the New York Yankees, can you ever slide anything by? I don't know about that. And every loss against New York seems to have like this big needle move of dire situations, right? You lose one, it feels like you lost three. You win one, it looks like you swept a four-game series. At least that's what the barometer of Blue Jay fandom is like. Anytime it's New York, anytime it's Boston. Although last night, yes, a lot of excitement in the city, and I think the ball game and the hockey game ended within like 15 minutes of each other. So downtown was just absolute chaos. And lopsided, right? Blue Jay fans were kind of dejected because it was such a good game. Pitcher's duel and tight contest again. And then everybody was filled with glee watching as the Leafs throttle the Lightning.
Obviously, games against the Yankees are going to be tough ones, right? They're a very good team. Jordan Montgomery's a good pitcher. They've got a lot of bats in that lineup. But you mentioned a good pitcher's duel, and that was maybe found money, right? With Ross Stripling, David Phelps, Trevor Richards, Adam Simber, they combined to give up 2-8, and you end up losing that one. And I'm not going to hang it all on Jimmy Garcia because there were some squandered opportunities at the plate as well. But how much has that hurt for you to get 8 innings of a bullpen day pretty clean and then not come away with the win?
It does. It hurts because, you know, that's now back-to-back outings for Jimmy Garcia where technically he got roughed up against Boston. I mean, let's be honest. He got stung a little bit against Boston. And then yesterday, the line for a margin of error is just so fine right now with the offense and the way that it is going. And those missed opportunities become glaring. Ross Stripling's been pretty good, you know, as a starter. You know, settling in there 2 times through the order. He's not going to go 3 times through the order. Doesn't matter what the pitch count is. They let him have a little bit of length against the Red Sox his last time out. But he's a really solid number 5. And there's an emergency need for a starter. Ross Stripling is going to be that guy. And you know you have to have your bullpen stacked up and ready to go. And this is another situation where the schedule has done the Blue Jays absolutely zero favors when it comes to how Charlie and Pete and Matt Bushman are going to navigate all these games with high leverage, you know, because of now, as we've seen, every game is close. But there are no off days that you can say, you know what, we can run an extra guy out there. We can, you know, burn an extra guy for a one-on-one to try to get this two-out situation locked up. Because they have an off day. They have not been afforded any time off whatsoever. But that's another thing. With all the success of the Blue Jays and the 15 wins and all the tight victories, the 9 wins of one run out of the 15, that's even a better thing to think about where this Blue Jays club is headed, because they have maneuvered the bullpen so well and they tried to limit the usage. While a lot of appearances, there just haven't been a lot of deep outings. You don't see these grind out 3 at-bats where it's taken 25, 28 pitches to get through these things. So I'm okay with how, I mean, you never want to lose the game, but you're okay about the usage of the guys in it. And, you know, you just didn't have a couple of big hits going the Blue Jays' way last night. And that was really unfortunate, especially with the runners in scoring position.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it. It's a weird game because I'm watching with a bit of a passive eye, I will admit, because I'm so locked in the Leafs and I'm sweating through my shirt watching them play even though they got a big lead. But yeah, the Jays just, I go, all right, that's 2 in a row for Jimmy. But he looked so great to start the year. And I don't know much about this guy other than his Blue Jays tenure and whatever his Fangraphs page tells me. But he was the trusted reliever that I loved him. I went, okay, they got this 8th inning guy. Now I'm a little shaken in that because we don't have very much sample in the player. And yeah, the sticks could have been better, and maybe we'll get to that. And there's a couple of other ancillary questions off of this. But what do you make of relievers early? Because, Ben, this is your sport. You're watching a ton of baseball. Do you put a little extra stock into how these guys perform early in a season? Because, yeah, with a guy like Bo, we kind of dismiss every piece of or lack of success that he has. But somebody like Jimmy Garcia, who's new with a ball club and is in a big leverage role, I tend to usually put more stock into what you see early.
Yeah, the spotlight is a little sharper, right? It's magnified because of the early situations, how important April is to the Blue Jays, how bad historically April has been for the Toronto Blue Jays. And you know, last year, right, you come out, you're a little clunky, and you miss the playoffs by a game. That's why April was so important, looking back last year, and is always important. You can't win anything, but you can certainly set yourself up for disaster the rest of the season if you come out of the gate and you're not good. And the bullpens are usually part of that, because guys in the rotation have pitch counts, and the way that baseball is today, you just don't see a lot of deep starts early in the season unless you're named Kevin Gausman. But for Jimmy Garcia, the Blue Jays really, really liked the fact that they were able to get him. And Jimmy Garcia, I talked to him in the clubhouse the other day, and I was asking him about his pitches and how he holds the pitches and all this other stuff. We talked a little bit about the free agency. He had a lot of interest, a lot of interest. And I said, well, what boiled down? Was it the years? Was it the overall cash? And he goes, he like pointed around the clubhouse. He goes, this, I wanted to come here because of what's going on here. So, you know, this is mutual excitement for Jimmy Garcia, looking at how this Blue Jays thing could roll for the next couple of years. And he wants to be a part of that bullpen. Now, His inconsistency right now is just pitch execution. The pitches just weren't executed, and they were thrown right over the middle of the plate, and they got tagged. And when you do that, no matter how excited you are, you still have to execute the pitches and get down to it. The guys like Jimmy Garcia, David Phelps, who's coming off the injury, you get to know Adam Simber a little bit more, Trevor Richards, somebody that the Blue Jays acquired, you know, that people are still kind of getting to know, and so are the Blue Jays overall. They have been thrust into massive, massive moments since they got here in June, July, and now we know what August and September were, right? Early in the season, the bullpen situation is so magnified because of the pitchers are usually ahead of the hitters, and everything else that factors into it. We talked about the pitch counts, and we talked about early usage. Early usage is a thing where you'd love to give guys off because you can save those bullets. You know that you'd love to have Jordan Romano's innings a little bit more restricted from the first couple of months, because that will save the bullets for August, and then adrenaline's going to take over and pitch you through September.
So Ben, looking at how the bullpen shakes out then, Adam Simber's been the guy that Montoyo goes to most often in high leverage spots, maybe not necessarily eighth inning, but good parts of the order, things like that. Does he miss enough bats for you to be that eighth inning righty? I think we can all agree that Romano's locked in and Mays is locked in from the left side, but the Simber, Phelps, Garcia, Richards thing feels pretty fluid if you're looking at, you know, you need a righty in a middle of the order seventh or in the eighth. Could Simber be that guy, or is there too much hesitation with how many balls in play he allows?
No, not hesitation, because it's the contact. You know, when I talk to people in the organization about that, one, they're okay with contact because it's usually soft. And the way Blue Jays shift and look, I mean, they're doing a remarkable job. I mean, an absolute remarkable job in the way that they're using analytics and then deploying their defensive setup. They're so pleased about that. And they're allowed a lot of flexibility. Luis Rivera, who's in charge of positioning the infielders, Mark Budzinski in the outfield alignment. I mean, they just are swimming in data, but they also can use the eye test. If they notice something specifically is maybe going to be better because Adam Simber's had a good fastball this week, let's say, and they think guys on the left side are going to get to it, perhaps a little late, they can adjust where they position their players by a step or two, you know, and have that autonomy in those situations. For Adam Simber and Tim Mesa, by the way, Simber the right-hander, he's got that submarine delivery. It looks like the ball's coming out of his white shoelaces. And then Tim Mesa, both guys are comfortable in their right-handed and left-handed splits. They would roll them out there if the matchups are good and be comfortable. Even with Simber, let's say two out of the three that he has to face is left-handed. They're comfortable with that. Tim Mesa is the exact same way. But let's say the lefty has to face two out of three right-handed hitters. They're completely comfortable with that because their stuff has been so good and plays so, so well. And Mesa's been that power sinker. I mean, against a right-handed hitter, that usually won't match up. But they have absolute faith in pitching those guys in higher leverage, and that's why they're getting the ball right now in high leverage.
JD is muted. He's trying to ask. JD.
No, I'm not muted.
You were muted.
Hyunjin Ryu thing.
It's okay. I was actually doing lip reading. I was doing just lip stuff.
Last night was an exciting night for all of us. There's a little excitement hangover, maybe, JD.
So, maybe one little tiny touch. You know, you got to celebrate just a tiny little bit. So, Ben, what I wanted to bring up with you is the bullpen ends up getting the focal point because the Jimmy thing happens and the lack of bats we've been talking about. And it's kind of weird, though, because offense baseball is down, and then we've got the Jays hitting the most home runs thing, and it's just a weird conversation. You also feel like Teoscar's on the mend. I saw you on TV the other day talking about how close he's getting, his massive arms and the cutoff sleeve shirt. He's on the mend. He should be close, and that's at least a solution to those problems. The bullpen hasn't been one. The starting pitching also has not been one. And so it's sort of buried the Hyunjin Ryu conversation a little bit, right? You're not doing updates on Ryu as frequently as Teoscar because the offense needs Teo. The offense wants that guy back. Ryu, I couldn't help but think of him during the start yesterday because Stripling's been good. And of course you're giving Ryu his spot back because he's Hyunjin Ryu. He's the higher ceiling play and he's your $20 million a year starter. He's a vet. He's respected, all these different things. You're hoping that he can still regain form. But Stripling has got that ERA sitting under four. You're right. He doesn't go deep into ball games, but he's been pretty reliable throughout his entire career. And we always forget about him until he's forced into this position, which is, all right, this guy's not just a bulk reliever. He can actually start baseball games. If Ryu comes back and he can't pitch, does this become an actual competition? Like, what happens with Stripling? Does he stay in that long man role regardless? How does this work?
Yeah, he's going to go back to the bullpen. You know, I talked with Ross Atkins in the dugout the other day and kicking around ideas. And I said, Ryu comes back, you know, are you going to, one, how long is he going to have to pitch in Buffalo? You know, is this going to be a one and done thing? Or are you going to need to have Hyunjin Ryu pitch a couple of times on a minor league rehab just to make sure he recovers and can bounce back the way that you want? And that still is to be determined. The player is going to dictate a lot of that. Most of these guys nowadays just want to do it one and done. I think it would definitely benefit Ryu to go down there and make a couple of starts because it's not only about the recovery now. They need Hyunjin Ryu to throw some strikes and be a more effective pitcher and get a little bit deeper into ball games. So when he checks out and everybody is happy with the way that he's throwing the baseball, Ryu will come back and he'll be in the rotation, and then that bumps Ross Stripling to maybe making one or two appearances a week, depending on the situation. And likely, because of that, the guy that backs up Hyunjin Ryu gives a different little bit of a look. You know, you're not going to lean on Ryu to go deep into a ball game, and Ross can easily serve that role, and it really pans out. That's really the end of the conversation. I don't think there's much of a competition when you look at who will stay in the rotation, but listen, if Ryu comes back and he's not Hyunjin Ryu, it's about winning games for the Toronto Blue Jays right now. That's the bottom line. So if there are deficiencies and if there are gaps and they become glaring, whether it's the lineup, whether it's the bullpen, whether it's the rotation, there are going to be changes that are going to have to be made. And that's the bottom line. So you give everybody the shot. And Ryu obviously is being, one, paid to throw every fifth day or sixth day because he loves that bonus day to get as deep as he can into ball games. But if it's going to hurt the effectiveness and ultimately cost the Blue Jays a position to put themselves into the win column, that's when the conversation gets much, much deeper. But for the short term, it's get Ryu healthy, get him back throwing every fifth day. And the way that you've got Ross Stripling and a combination kind of Trent Thornton, who is serving the old Stripling role, since now Stripling is a starter and a rotation guy, you know, that can bulk up the bullpen getting stripped back there too.
Ben Wagner, play-by-play announcer for the Blue Jays on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning, buddy.
Thank you, guys. Have a good one.
Ben Wagner, voice of the Jays on the radio. Check that out. JD, we owe you some credit, I believe, on Bo Bichette coming around.
Yeah, I called it like I always call it. Like, I don't know what to say. Like, I'm always right. I get it right a lot, and this is another situation. No, well, here's the thing. Bo was hitting so poorly and has been in such a slump that this is the move, is you buy stock on the baseball player that's historically good and struggling. This is an easy play. But I really did love Bo's approach last night. It was a little better, right? He's drawing more pitches, and I like that. The first strikeout was horrific, let's be honest. The first strikeout, the 0-2 count, and then he gets bounced, the bounce one in front of the plate. You go, oh my God, Bo, there's no saving you. And then the rest of the game, he locked in. It's almost like he needed to have that awful moment to get a little bit better. So I don't know. I think Bo is turning a corner. His dad was on with Blair and Barker yesterday and had some interesting things to say about him, so catch their podcast. But I would say that, yeah, Bo is going to start to round into form here. I'm hard-pressed to believe that he's going to stay at a 543 OPS guy or whatever the hell he was heading into yesterday's game.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I did my fast breakdown last week on Bo as well, and just kind of, hey, you don't want him to lose too much of who he is, but you also can't have him be this extreme of a – of a, I don't know, what's the baseball term for chucker in baseball. So yeah, I think it's good process behind a couple of those PAs yesterday. Even the game prior, he had that very loud out where he ripped one to shortstop and the process was there. That's what I'm looking for, right? Like even when he's playing poorly, we've seen it, the grand slam or the opposite field home run, like Bo can put a charge into one even when he's struggling, because that's the type of player he is, and that's why he's as aggressive as he is. But it's the process side of stuff where I thought that double, especially yesterday, comes on a really good piece of work at the plate. And you know, that recognition of, hey, being aggressive isn't just swinging at everything. It's coming up to the plate with the plan of, this is my pitch or this is my location, and I'll be really aggressive if it fits in that shoebox. And if it doesn't, then I'm okay being selective because I have confidence hitting with two strikes anyway.
Yeah.
So, that's supposed to be one of the benefits of being a good two-strike hitter, right? Is you can wait on your pitch and not worry about, you know, struggling when you're down 0-2 or 1-2 or 2-2 or whatever. So, positive improvements there. I'll be looking for more of that today, certainly, because the pitching matchups don't get a ton easier as we go. But Jameson Taillon is gettable if you're Bo Bichette.
Taillon's gettable. I believe Bo is going to turn a little bit of a corner here. It's going to be a positive regression. I hope that it isn't just a blip, that it does become consistent. But again, I've never really been worried about the plate approach, even though he hasn't turned on the heater. And our buddy Ben Nicholson-Smith, I think, has done a really good job of highlighting that's what's going wrong with his approach. What I actually need to see from Bo is just the fielding improve and settle down and get back to where it was last year. Because that to me is less proven than his bat. His bat to me is something that we have kind of figured out is going to be all right. And until this becomes, you know, 100 more plate appearances of something similar to this, I'm not going to stress over it too much. But the fielding is the one area where Bo's got to be a little bit better. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Jen Botterill. Let's get back in the Leafs. Let's just finish the show. Just basically Leafs. Tons of Leafs outside of the Wake and Rake. But yeah, Jen Botterill, Chris Chelios, Christopher Stieg. A lot of winners. Did we see a winner last night?
Big day for Chris's.
Big Chris with a C-H or Chris with a K? Which is the better Chris? We'll find out on the Fan Morning Show. JD Blake and Ayler, Sports F5, Night of the Fan.